Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I am Royfield Brown, who is back in my hometown of Birmingham in England, which means that I'm in Europe, which is somewhat perfect considering that we're going to move focus this week. And we're not doing the UK, the US or even Canada. We're going to turn our focus to the Federal German Republic. And we have with us Tiran Fisher, who is an outsider's insider, or is it an insider's outsider? One of those is probably correct. Who is an American who's been domiciled in Berlin for how long now, Tiran?
I've been living in Berlin since April, but I've been living in Germany since 1993.
Uh-huh. So you're practically German then. I'm sure you've forgotten the odd English phrase.
Well, I keep listening to your podcast to keep up.
So Tiran is an expat, somebody who has been in Germany for quite some time, and he's going to be able to give us somewhat of an expert eye view as to how the German political system works, because this election, which just happened, the election was in... When exactly was that? And this goes to one of the key parts why this is actually fascinating. Oh, September the 26th. So
yeah, there you go.
So the election was September the 26th. The result was known definitely by the 27th in terms of which parties had what result. But it's only been in the last week that we've had the coalition agreement. So first off, before we kind of look at that coalition agreement, why does it take so long for Germany to decide who exactly is going to be the next chancellor after it goes to the polls?
Well, in terms of the numbers, percentage-wise, a couple different coalitions were possible. So theoretically, the coalition that we had before, the CDU-CSU and the SPD, the Grand Coalition, was possible. Then the so-called Jamaica coalition would have been possible with the CDU as the black color on the Jamaican flag and the Greens and the FDP for the yellow. And the third possibility was the traffic light coalition that we have.
Tiran, let me jump in. I think you've slightly jumped the gun. The answer I was expecting is because no political party gets more than 50%, so all German governments are somewhat of a coalition.
Right. Yeah, I left that out. That was not a possibility. Yeah, there was that's only been a possibility once in all of German history.
Well, that's what I found somewhat fascinating when I did my a little history lesson deep dive, was that it was actually the Christian Democrats and the Christian Social Union, which are the Bavarian offshoot of the same party that in the 50s and the 60s were able to basically have like a one party government. But ever since then, German politics has meant that there has to be this kind of wrangling, this kind of horse race after the election to find out which party is going to lead the government, but then who is going to be the kind of secondary party. And traditionally, it's been the centrist party, which has almost been the kingmaker, hasn't it been?
Well, I think mostly you would say either the center-left SPD or the center-right CDU-CSU was the senior partner, and they needed a junior partner. And traditionally, it was the FDP until the FDP switched sides from Helmut Schmidt in, I think it was in the 80s, right? Early 80s, and went to the CDU with Helmut Kohl. That was the beginning of the Helmut Kohl reign. And so, yeah, and this time, two parties weren't enough. This is the first time that two parties weren't enough to make a majority. So except if it had been a grand coalition, but nobody wanted the grand coalition again. The grand coalition had sort of petered out. It lost all dynamism. And both parties were sort of being drawn, sucked into the center, and nobody knew exactly which party stood for what. And they weren't able to have much of a profile.
That's interesting that you say that the party's been kind of sucked into the centre. We've had 16 years worth of Angela Merkel, who has been the preeminent European politician. You know, she's, I couldn't believe it. When you say 16 years, but to put it in perspective, there's a shot of her doing her first conference with Western leaders when she became Chancellor of Germany, and Jacques Chirac was still the president of France. You know, Tony Blair was the Prime Minister of England. And there have been 4 other British Prime Ministers since that. And that's before we then look at Germany. You know, Bush was the president. So explain to us the effect that she's actually had on German politics, of which you kind of characterise by saying the parties are almost kind of sucked into the middle. How do Germans view her tenure?
Well, I think it's been a long transition. I think as you point out, 16 years is a long time, and she was quite a bit younger. And there's a really great movie in German theaters right now called The Unbendables or The Unbeugsam, about German women in politics since the beginnings of the Federal Republic of Germany. And it's a great document of the struggles that women politicians go through. But the last scene of it is Schröder, the chancellor before her, saying in a TV round with all of the people right after the election, with all the candidates, the chancellor candidates after the election, that nobody wants her as chancellor. And the next scene in the movie is her being sworn in. So I think that's sort of a document of the at least the feeling that that Schröder had at the time, that he was able to say that on television. I mean, it was sort of a nasty comment in any event, but he felt okay saying it. Some people said he might have been drunk at the time. But in any event, she was a bit of an underdog coming in. And I think they're going to be looking back three things that everybody will remember her for. And certainly the first one is the Euro crisis and the financial crisis of 2008, where she instituted or brought through a law making what they call short work. So essentially shortening the working week and providing funds for companies so that they could keep the workers on. And essentially nobody lost their job. I mean, the unemployment did not go up during the crisis. And I think everybody was very grateful for that. The second one, of course, is then the refugee situation 2015, 2016, where Germany absorbed well over a million refugees. And there was the moment where they were all at the Hungarian border. And the EU has a system of distributing the refugees. They're supposed to get registered in the country that they come in, and that country has to deal with them. And Hungary was not at all ready to deal with all the refugees at their border. And so she sort of broke protocol and said, we're going to take you. And of course, the rest of the history, they all came, or most of them came to Germany. They did get distributed a bit through I don't want to say Germany took them all, but they did get distributed to some of the northern, northwestern countries.
Tyrion, let me stop you on that point, because it's inconceivable. Let's just call this, and let's just be honest. It's inconceivable that the United Kingdom or the United States would take in 1 million brown people in a matter of less than a year. Inconceivable. How did she manage to do that without having massive political blowback?
Well, it's not quite true that she didn't have massive political blowback. The AfD was sort of a minor part. So the far right alternative for Germany or alternative for Deutschland, AfD, had no chance of getting into any parliaments in 2014. And with the refugee crisis, they did get in, eventually even into the lower house of parliament, the Bundestag. So there was a blowback, but I think it is a testament to organization. I mean, there was a lot of stress at the time in the country, but a testament to German organization and ability to deal with these crises. And I think a lot of people respect her personally for pulling it through. And the quote that everybody remembers was, wir schaffen das, so we'll get it done, we'll do it. Some people, still don't like to talk about her or talk about it, but I think most people respect the moral fortitude that it took.
You said there were three things that she's going to be remembered by, and I stopped you on point number two. What's the third and final one?
Yeah, the pandemic. So the current situation that we're still in. But I think, you know, her critics would say she was never very good, you know, with figuring out a plan for the future, a visionary. She wasn't much of a visionary, really, I think, is the problem. And a lot of the legislative progress that's been made in the last years has really come from the SPD, and she sort of just took it over. And that was sort of a problem for the CDU-CSU and also for the SPD, that she was taking over their policies and getting credit for them. But I think besides the critics who say that, you know, she's just responding to crises and not really much of a visionary, I think and I've talked to many Germans who've said they never voted for her, but they're going to miss her. And they wish they could vote for her now. And I really think, talking to a lot of people, what stands out about her is she's, you know, almost the polar opposite to somebody like Trump or Putin. She's very quiet, very reserved. She's got a bit of a sense of humor. She's a backroom dealer. I think German politics tends to make backroom dealers out of their politicians. They're not usually the super charismatic types. But the strange thing is the last one standing is in control. And she was like that. She got rid of her opponents. Somehow they all disappeared. And that's also a problem. That's one of the reasons why the CDU isn't able to continue in her legacy, because she managed to get rid of anybody who was number two in the party who might have threatened her.
Well, that's a great jumping off point for us. So the CDU has a new leader now. But tell us about that whole process. If you've been leading a party for some 16 years, apart from just slaying all potential opponents, you know, you're going to leave a void anyway. So how has the CDU gone about getting its new leader, knowing that she was going to step down in this election? And then we'll start to move on to the setting of the current election, which happened in September.
So what usually it depends on the party. The CDU tends to, the CDU, now we're talking about, not the CSU, not the Bavarian sister party. The CDU has the leader of the party. If they have the chancellery, then the chancellor is usually the leader of the party. And Merkel was the leader of the party, the chairman of the party for much of her time. But at some point, she hands it over to somebody else to take over those duties. And that would sort of normally be the designate for her successor. And most of them sort of died in that position. So sort of the second, you know, the second league, if you will, the minor leagues of German politics are the federal states. And generally speaking, the bigger federal states, the premier, equivalent to a U.S. governor, is then sort of picked as the head of the party. And that's who Laschet was. He was the premier of North Rhine-Westphalia.
Gotcha. Right. So we have a situation whereby the world is under a century-defining pandemic. At least initially, Germany is seen as been doing quite well in that pandemic. And people seem to be quite adherent to the various rules, etc. I myself was in Berlin just last year, and people were scrupulously following all of the diktats that people had to do. So we have a pandemic. We have a situation whereby Britain has exited the European Union. Why is it that the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, went into this election, not on a wave of popularity, but kind of knowing that they were going to be in for a fight with the SDP, the Social Democrats? What has actually changed, would you say, in German politics that meant that the outcome of this election was going to be the first one for some 16 years, which potentially nobody could call?
Going into the election, people actually thought that Laschet was going to be much stronger. And because he was pretty well liked in his federal state of North Rhine-Westphalia, but he just wasn't very personable, and the party started to lose. And at the same time, the Green Party went way up. They put Annalena Baerbock forward, and actually for a couple of days, the Green Party was polling above the CDU, which is way above historic levels. So usually the Green Party is somewhere in the 8 to 15% range. And the SPD is somewhere in the low 20s, and the CDU-CSU is in the 30s. And so the CDU was dropping down into the low 20s, and the Greens overtook them. And then the candidate for the Green Party, Annalena Baerbock, had a couple scandals, and the Green Party sort of steadily went down to a pretty high level, but not to where you know, not as low as the, you know, not a terribly low level, but not as high as they had been. And slowly but surely, this SPD's candidate Scholz, who has been the finance minister in the last, who's kind of a dull guy. He's one of the Guardian actually painted him as having the charm of a mid-level bank teller, and he's very monotone when he speaks. So it was kind of surprising, but because Baerbock had made so many mistakes and Laschet made some mistakes, the SPD went way up in the polls at the end and overtook.
Gotcha. So just explain to me the Green Party. Very obviously, I think we all kind of understand primarily what Green politics actually are. But you said that they were riding really high in the polls. I've always seen Germany as a country which has got really strong green credentials, at least politically anyway. Why do you think they were doing so well now? Is it a case of because of the kind of climate emergency that Germans just think now it's the time for the Green Party to have more sway? Or is this kind of lethargy and apathy kind of unfracturing of the left?
Well, let's see. Well, first of all, so your CDU-CSU is primarily your rural population. That's their main constituency. Their main voters are the rural population and people in favor of big business. The SPD has always traditionally been the party of the workers, of the unions, like Labour in the UK. In the beginning, and the FDP would be the party of small businesses, medium-sized businesses, doctors, lawyers, professionals, and you know, people who have their own businesses. So they represent medium-sized business, big business, but are socially a lot more liberal than the CDU-CSU in a lot of questions. The Green Party comes in the early 80s, and they're basically a hippie party. And when the Schroeder government came in at the end of the 90s, there was already a conflict within the party between the more realistic side, or realos side of the party, and the fundamental side of the party, the fundis. And at that point, sort of the realos won. You know, we had the Kosovo War and Bosnia and eventually Afghanistan, right? And they were a party to those missions. And this was the Peacenik Party. So they had some problems after that. They stayed in government until both parties were voted out and Merkel came in. But they had a bit of a problem there. Their ideals were a lot higher than what they realized in government they were able to get through. And I think what's happened is over the last, well, in that government as well, the SPD made some laws and legislation that took benefits away from unemployed and poor and working class, especially the welfare law, reduced the amount of money and increased a lot of penalties for people who were unemployed. And they lost a lot of support. And at the same time, the one part of the SPD that's sort of the intelligentsia side, the teachers, the professors, the students that might have been in the SPD 30 years ago were starting to move towards the Green Party. And I think most people would agree that the Green Party is now the party of university towns. It's the party of this. It's more the party of cities in general. And the SPD has lost a lot of voters to the Green Party. So that's part of the reason why the Green Party was riding so high at the beginning of the campaign. And I think just a lot of people were looking towards the Green Party as the only party that really had a clear vision on the left side. They didn't really know what the SPD wanted. They didn't really know what the CDU wanted, but the Greens had a clear program. So I think that has a lot to do with why the Greens were able to get so high in the polls.
So you've told us about Laschet and Baerbock. Tell us a little bit about Olaf Scholz. Who is he? He's going to be the new Chancellor of Germany. Are people excited about him?
I don't think people are excited about him. Like I said before, he's got sort of a monotone delivery. And his nickname has been the Scholzomat, sort of that he's on automatic overdrive or something like that. I don't know. His delivery isn't that great. He is definitely a political insider. So he's been in the last years, he's been the finance minister. He's also been in other ministries. He was the vice chancellor the Grand Coalition. So he knows government. He knows the international stage. I think he is definitely a sign of stability. He's from Hamburg. Hamburg, for United States listeners, generally speaking, Northern Germany is sort of like New England in the United States. The people are a little bit more reserved, a little bit more dry in their humor. Yeah. So he's got a little bit of that.
Gotcha. Right. So the election happens in towards the end of September, and the SPD end up with, let me have a look at my notes, with 27% of the vote. Well, sorry, 26.7%. Which means that they're the largest party for the first time since 2002. The ruling CDU-CSU coalition, they slipped to 24%, which is somewhat of a significant decline since 2017. And the Greens have their best election result in their history. Explain for us novices who don't know an awful lot about German politics, the machinations of how these parties form their governments and the various kind of sub rules like the 5% rule, etc., etc. Really put us in the place is the reason why it takes so long. The election was in September, we're at the start of December, and the government is only just kind of getting into place.
Well, you mentioned the 5% rule. That keeps small parties out. That's to avoid what happened in the Weimar Republic, so that they're not just a myriad of parties and it's difficult to get a coalition together. Like, let me leave that. But so after the election, normally in the ideal situation, one party would have a majority. But that, like we mentioned before, hardly ever happened. So in most of German history, it's been a two-party coalition in government. But this time, the Greens and there were the only two parties that could have ruled would have been the Grand Coalition continuing. Essentially, everybody was tired of the Grand Coalition, and nobody wanted it. The CDU, CSU didn't want to be the junior partner now to the SPD. The SPD was happy to do it with to govern with somebody else. So they looked to the Greens, and it still wasn't enough. So they needed a third partner, and the third partner was the FDP. And so in the very beginning, the FDP was like made gestures that they might be interested in a Jamaica coalition, CDU, Greens, and the FDP. If they had not gone into the traffic light coalition, that would have been another option. But essentially, after the election, the CDU-CSU imploded because they had done so much more poorly than in the previous election. And when that happens, parties tend to implode. And that's definitely what's happening. So Laschet is still nominally the leader of the CDU-CSU, but they're looking for a new leader.
As I kind of understand it, you have the various parties, and it's kind of the impetus is for the largest party to try and find its coalition partners, which are going to take it over 50% within right. The Bundestag. So hence, there's a whole lot of wrangling, and the parties kind of come into an election expecting there to be these long, drawn out negotiations. How exactly does that work in terms of policies? Does the SPD, do they go into a negotiation saying, right, here are two or three policies which are non-negotiable, these are kind of negotiable, who wants to in effect play with this type of thing? Give us a real sense of how that horse trading actually works on the policy level, and then maybe then give us the examples of the policies of this new government as a way of kind of underlining that whole process and how it works.
So the process can be as complicated or as simple as all negotiations can be. The reality is there was really no other very viable option. So all the parties right at the beginning sort of knew we're going to have to make this work somehow. If one of us ducks out, it's going to be pretty nasty. I mean, there was sort of the threat of new elections, which has never happened in Germany. Nobody wanted anything else to happen. So right at the beginning, it's sort of many, many rounds of negotiations, pre-negotiations, negotiations to set up the next negotiations, and then final negotiations somewhere down the line. And yes, like you said, each party is going to come to the table with more or less non-negotiables. And now the interesting thing about these negotiations was, The last government, the CDU, CSU, the Greens, and the FDP tried to make a coalition, the so-called Jamaica coalition, and the FDP backed out, and then it had to go back to the Grand Coalition, and they went in very hard, and part of the problem was the CDU. The rumors are the CDU was leaking a lot of what was going on in the negotiations. And that was making the negotiations impossible. This time they went into the negotiations and they made a pact that they weren't gonna leak anything. And I think most people feel that that was an incredible sign of dedication to the negotiations and also an incredible trust building measure for the three partners. So you really got every day that there wasn't a leak, there was nothing coming out of the negotiations. Everybody sort of felt, what's going on? Why don't we hear anything? But at the same time, once it did land, people were pretty impressed that the parties had really kept to their word and kept it secret. So what we found out after, once the negotiation paper was put out, was that each party negotiated pretty hard. And I saw a talk show with Linna, the leader of the FDP, and Habeck, one of the leaders of the Green Party. And you could see there was a lot of mutual respect there. They're really different characters. Linda's got this kind of frat boy air to him, and Habeck is much more reserved and green. He dresses a little bit more simply and speaks a little bit more straightforward. But you could tell there was a great deal of mutual respect there. And I think the media is trying to find little places where there's problems. But I think at the end of the day, the negotiations went very well, and I think all three parties were able to get a fair amount through. So, yeah, do we want to go into the actual points of the coalition?
Yeah, I think we should now. So, run us over those kind of main kind of policy promises which this coalition government has given to the German people.
Yeah, so let's start with the SPD. The SPD, being sort of like the Labour Party, they needed to get some of their issues through first. And I think the most important one was the 12 euro minimum wage. Then keeping the...
Tyrion, just very quickly. That surprised me that it was actually that low in Germany. I presumed, in the UK, the minimum wage is, it's less than £10, which in a dollar value is going to be about $13-14. And euros is round about the same when you convert it. I thought that you guys would have been a little bit more progressive with that type of legislation.
Yeah, I think it affects 10 million people at the end of the day. So it's not something around 10 million. The thing about Germany is most people aren't affected by the minimum wage. Most people wages or salaries are governed by labor agreements between the labor unions and the employers unions or employers associations would be the better word. And those get negotiated every couple of years, depending on the negotiations themselves. If they negotiate, that it'll be every 2 years or 5 years or whatever. But most people are fall under those agreements. So the minimum wage is really primarily for low-level service workers in the eastern part of Germany and in the Ruhr area. But if you're in Munich and you're cutting hair, you're going to be earning probably more than 12 euros an hour. But if you're in some little town outside of Dresden, you might just be getting a 3 euro haircut. So it's a lot more difficult. So it helps to balance out the different areas of Germany.
Gotcha. All right. So they've promised that there's going to be a 12 euro minimum wage. Tell us about pensions.
Yeah. So that was another big thing. I mean, for decades now, people have said the pensions aren't going to be secure, and that was part of the agreement that the pensions are going to stay or at the level that they're at. And also the age is not going to go up or down. So that's a big thing that the SPD wanted. The other thing that the SPD wanted was to change. I already mentioned the welfare scheme that people get after they've been unemployed for a while. It's sort of like welfare in the United States or the dole in the UK. Like I said before, the Schroeder government reduced those the benefits and made it easier to get penalties, And they've changed the name to something like citizens' income. So it sort of sounds like a general basic income, but it's not. It's still just a welfare amount, and the money isn't changing. It just should be more difficult for the unemployment office to install penalties on people who aren't looking for work and things like that. But it's kind of a big name change for the SPD, because that was kind of one of the programs that they put through that kind of lost them a lot of votes.
And on that note,
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm going to quickly pause you and say to the people in the audience, this is a recording of the podcast Mid-Atlantic, which normally looks at US, UK, and sometimes Canadian news and politics. Today, we're looking at the Federal Republic of Germany. We're looking at the fact that Germany has just had this 2 to 3 month period of political wrangling for it to come up with the composition of its new government. And we are speaking to American in Berlin, Tyrion Fischer, who has given us somewhat of an expert eye view of how this new coalition is actually going to work. So I'm going to finish my questions in approximately 3 minutes or so. If you have a question for Tyrion about Germany and its politics and how it goes forming its governments, please raise your hand. I'll call you up on stage. You will be part of the podcast Mid-Atlantic. Mr. F, there's one thing which is kind of iconic about Germany is its no speed limit on the autobahns. That was somewhat of a political football. Tell us why.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing about that is the Greens went in, it seems the Greens went in the negotiations with that high on their list of priorities to get a speed limit of 130 kilometers an hour, 120 kilometers an hour, something like they have in Austria or Switzerland or the other countries in Europe all around Germany. But it seems, and some people with a cynical tongue might say that Lindner, who's the head of the Liberals, drives a Porsche, so it wasn't in his interest. But at the end of the day, I think the FDP was representing the interest of the German car manufacturing industry. And I think it's legitimate to say that the image of the German car driving down the Autobahn without a speed limit is part of the German brand, is part of the German car brand in any event. And I don't think Green people who vote for the Green Party care about that. And I think I think a lot of people who believe in the Green Party and voted for the Green Party see that as a big loss.
Why is this thing so emblematic of a way of seeing German identity? Is it akin to freedom? I can drive as fast as I can.
You know, I don't think that many people actually drive that much faster. So I think the percentage of the population who drive.
I'll have you know, sir, I once drove from Bologna to Augsburg and then from Augsburg to Luxembourg, and I had a British sports car, an MG, and I floored it as soon as I got over the German border. I could not believe the speed that I was going. I was doing about 110 miles an hour, and still cars were passing me.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I'm exaggerating. But, but I think 90% of the drivers of the road wouldn't mind it being 130 kilometers an hour. I don't think there are that many cars that can drive. I mean, if you're driving, what was that? So you're driving about 180 kilometers an hour, I think, right?
Yeah.
Something like
that. A snail's pace. It was obviously a snail's pace. You know,
You're exaggerating a little bit. There are not that many cars that are driving much faster than 180. Yes, it happens, and one car will pass you going 250 or something like that, 250 kilometers an hour, but it's not that common.
All right. Okay. We dealt with the speed limit. We've talked about the new – you talked about the head of the Green Party, Baerbock. She's going to be the foreign minister. Am I right in saying that it's always the person, it's always the junior coalition partner that has the foreign ministry? And then also, what changes can we expect from German foreign policy with her as its foreign secretary?
The foreign ministry used to be the ministry that the junior partner wanted the most. You know, back in the days of Genscher or even Fischer, it was the one with the highest reputation. But it's turned really to finances. The finance minister, you know, has his fingers on the purse and has a lot more control. And that's why the designated chancellor, Olaf Scholz, was at last the finance minister. So whether the junior partner absolutely necessarily needs to get the foreign office, it's generally still that way, but it's not necessarily that way, I would say. It's you know, and I think the international stage has changed quite a bit in the last years. For example, there was the COP26 a couple weeks ago, and you know, Russia and China only sent their foreign minister. Their foreign ministers, and that's seen as a slight. And I think the last years, if somebody wanted to get something done in Germany, then Angela Merkel would go. Not. Do you even know the foreign minister of Germany? I don't think most people do.
Hans
right
Dietrich
now.
Genscher. No, there you go.
A couple of years ago.
But you made an excellent point that, no, I don't know. Without looking, I don't know. Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, I've heard the Secretary of State of the United States a couple of times in the last days, and I had to concentrate to remember his name. You know, it's just not as important as it used to be when it was Albright, for example.
What are they going to be the international consequences? What does this mean for NATO, the EU? What does this mean about how is this going to set the tone for Germany and its place on the world stage?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because I've looked through the contract a number of times now, the coalition contract, and there are something like 38 pages on foreign policy. And I wouldn't say it's a revolution in foreign policy, but it's a bit of a sea change. So the German foreign policy over the last years has really been I've seen it described as opportunistic and mercantilistic. So they were looking for trade. That was sort of the driving force, trade and trade and more trade. And human rights, if we trade with them enough and they get rich, they'll start paying attention to human rights, hopefully someday, in terms of China, Russia, Belarus, whatever. And the new document really changes the priorities. The human right, if you look through the pages on foreign policy, human rights is all over the place. So as a high priority and how important it is, women's rights, feminist foreign policy is mentioned in there in English, strangely enough, and water, resources, all these sort of things are really important. Also interesting in the area of bilateral, right at the beginning, you know, NATO, UN, very important. Then after that, the US is mentioned a couple of paragraphs, and the next country that's mentioned is the UK as a important partner. And it sort of goes down the list of positions. The positions are, I think most people consider the positions not very hard positions on countries like Belarus, Russia, China. They're flexible, let's put it that way. But I think there's going to be a drive from both the FDP side of the coalition as well as the Greens towards human rights as a priority. And having Annalena Baerbock as the Green foreign minister opens that door. I don't know how successful she's going to be. I think we're living in a very difficult international environment for Germany to be pushing human rights. But it would be interesting to see Germany do that.
Now is the time, good people in the audience. Raise your hand. We have an American who's resident in Germany, who's somewhat of an expert on German politics and culture. So if you ever had a burning question, now's your time to raise your hand and to ask it. Mr. F, what's the general mood after, you know, 3 months worth of protracted negotiations? Are Germans just like, are they still excited about a new government after 3 months worth of wrangling? Are they just exhausted and just saying, just get on and just get governing? What's the general mood after an election?
When the parties came out last week on Wednesday, they had a bit of a show to present the contract. And I think my American DNA came out. I felt a exuberance and optimism from the politicians on the stage that I have never experienced in German politics. It was really astounding how to see the three the representatives of the three parties on the stage there, just saying that they cooperated, that they're optimistic, they're looking forward to working together, and I thought that was quite a brilliant moment. Then I started talking to Germans, and I realized it was just my American DNA thinking that that politics could be optimistic. They were criticizing everything from the way the people were standing, how close they were standing, where they were standing, what they said, everything. So I was a little bit surprised, but I wasn't alone. I have talked to quite a few people who are optimistic about this coalition. And one of the interesting things was Laschet, the candidate from the CDU-CSU, who had failed miserably to get his party into government, he complimented them on the way they did it. So not just the way they presented it, but the fact that they had kept their negotiations secret and the whole deal. He showed quite a bit of respect for that. So, and I think a lot of political commentators haven't only seen the negative side. So I think we're hopeful. On the other hand, right now, the pandemic in Germany is pushing everybody's moods quite down, as well as the weather.
You know, but, what? That...
Yeah, the situation with the pandemic has been quite depressing.
I need to stop you, Mr. F. I need to stop you because I know that Kelly Saunders, who just brought her up on stage, has a question specifically about how Germans are dealing with any potential lockdowns. Kelly, your question.
It's really great to be able to speak to you, and I appreciate Royfield you bringing me up here. I know that there's been a lot of talk about different policies in different parts of Europe. I think Austria just had a pretty significant lockdown. I could be wrong. But I was speaking to someone who actually is from America, lives in Germany currently, maybe a week ago. And then also to someone who's married to a German fellow. And it seemed that they both felt like Germany would likely wind up being one of the last places that went into lockdown, but that they would probably do it. I was curious, and I know you've been talking a lot about election politics, whatnot. How comparable is the situation to America in terms of, you know, how politicized something like the pandemic and potential lockdowns, how politicized that gets? And did that play any part in the elections? And I forgot what the second part of the question was. Oh, and how likely do you think the case is that Germany will go into lockdowns?
Let me start with your question about the effects on the election. I think an argument can be made that the FDP did as well as they did, partially because the Liberal Party stands for civil rights. And in that sense, they've always been sort of championing the idea of people being able to decide whether they get vaccinated, whether they wear a mask. And a lot of the measures that have been implemented, they've been a little bit skeptical. Not to say that they've been anti-vaxxers or anything that extreme, but they've been a little bit critical. And them being in government right now and having had quite a few people vote for them, I think it's going to be difficult for them to roll backwards and allow a lockdown and mandate vaccinations. However, today, the Constitutional Court, the Supreme Constitutional Court of Germany, ruled that the measures from the last lockdown that were just ended, actually, were constitutional. So that kind of opens the door legally, not completely, because every situation is different in terms of the law. But the basic balance of proportionality, how many of our rights are being taken away for what reasons, has sort of been laid down. That's okay. I'd like to point out that Udo's on the stage, and he's also German, so I don't know if he'd like to say something.
Hi, Tyrone. The highest priority for the new government from 9th December on, for the next 12 months, the priority is the fight against the corona pandemic. And in moment we discuss duty for vaccination, cause the numbers of people who get an infect, no, about coronavirus, are rising and rising, and the hospitals are full and fuller. And so I think most measures in the next months is a fight against the corona pandemic. And then we will see on the relation you discussed with the partner which we are coupled since 60 years is France. And the first visit for future Chancellor Scholz will go to Paris. It's, I think, most of the chancellors are going to Paris, because France and Germany are the most important states in Europe to hold this complicated construction of European Union together, and in between Europe and out of Europe, I think it's the States. Yeah, it's USA. It's our partner since the end of the Second World War, and either if there is a President Trump, and it is ending, and now I think the relations between USA and Germany are much better.
But to maybe finish off the answer for Kelly, I don't have a crystal ball, but right now vaccine mandates are being discussed quite a lot, and a lockdown.
Compulsory is, mandates, you
mean. Yeah, compulsory vaccinations is being discussed quite at the moment. And for a while people were saying, we don't want to rule it out. But now it's more, we need to go in that direction. That's what Scholz is saying and other people as well. Mm. It's possible that it's going to go that way. Lockdown, I think the big debate about lockdowns right now is do we lock down the people who are vaccinated? Do we punish the people who did their duty and went and got vaccinated? And I think a lot of people want to avoid that from happening. So it might go stronger in the direction of what Austria did, of just not allowing unvaccinated people out for anything that's not completely necessary.
Yeah, I think most of the people are tired in Germany. We have now, from the adult people, we have 80% who got a vaccine and 20% not. And the 80% say, hey, why we have the vaccinating and we don't have our freedom we like. Only while 20% of the people do it not.
That is the same question which I think those that believe the science are asking all throughout the liberal West. You know, it's a case of the tail wagging the dog type of thing. But I don't get too hung up on COVID politics. I know it's incredibly important. And as we said, the SPD are thinking about having compulsory vaccinations to follow on from the Austrians. But Manville, you've joined us on stage. Lovely to see you again, sir. Long time no see. What's your question?
Where do you think Germany in dealing with Eastern Europe, are they going to defend the rest of it, save for maybe Ukraine, against Russian aggression? Or are they more interested in avoiding conflict with Russia than keeping a westernized wall between them and Putin?
Yeah, difficult question. I think Germany is trying very hard right now to keep Poland on board. Germany and Poland have been at odds for the last couple of months. The Polish Supreme Court ruled that the Polish constitution is above the EU charter and EU agreements. And that's was sort of a de facto leaving of the European Union. That's all kind of on hold. They're being punished with €1 million a day, which is essentially taking away all of the money that they would be getting from the EU or moving in that direction. So there's this sort of fight underneath the surface there. Part of the problem is that Poland and Hungary are sort of on, let's say, the same team. And as long as two countries are working together, the EU can't really do anything. If it was just one country, then they could. So essentially, the elections in Hungary are next spring. And there's a candidate there who represents the opposition. If he were to come into power, it would be a completely different ball game. As far as the Ukraine and Russia are concerned, I'm pretty sure that on the military level, Germany is going to be completely in lockstep with NATO.
But essentially, they would be making up the bulk of the NATO forces. If the U.S. tries to stay out of it, Germany would be pretty much the only player. You can gather up some Latvians and some Estonians and some French soldiers together, but I don't think the
Manville, you're so wide off the mark that I have to step in. There's this very weird situation geopolitically when it comes to Germany and the German military, for very obvious reasons, because of World War II. Germany militarily cannot lead any peacekeeping force. It never does in the world, let alone any aggressive force. And when it comes to European competent militaries after the United States, arguably, and I'm not saying this because I'm a Brit, the British Army is the military which has the most amount of technical firepower. It's not only a military power, but it can project power with aircraft carriers, etc. And then France is on a similar level. Germany wouldn't have the political, let alone military, where for all let alone will, to lead any mission against Russian aggression. It just can't happen because of the Second World War. The Bundeswehr has a very peculiar place in NATO because of World War II, which is, we didn't discuss this with Tyrion, but one of the interesting things that Tyrion kind of said to me off mic before we did the show was that whilst Germany isn't committing 3% of its GDP towards the military, it's committing 3% to what exactly, Tyrion? How did you describe that?
They want to. I'm not sure how solid the commitment is, but the idea of the commitment is 3% of GDP to international engagements, and the idea would be 2% for military expenditures, 0.7 for economic development. And then the rest three would be for the foreign ministry, essentially. So it's a little bit of a play out of games. You want 2% from us, we're going to give you 3. But we're going to do it on our terms for peaceful international development, I think is the idea.
And it is going to be quite a odd situation with the U.S. putting... Not that the U.S. is putting the EU at arm's length, but the U.S. is dealing with their own separate deal with Britain. Britain being no longer an EU member, but still participating in NATO.
But
very Western European conflict would be interesting.
One of the reasons why Putin could grab the Crimea and the eastern Ukraine is because there is no... projection of protection of power to the Ukraine. Ukraine wanted to join NATO at one point, and that created massive ructions. And NATO basically said no, and the Russians said absolutely no. So it meant that, in effect, the Russians had a free hand. But that's slightly another thing. Alex Gregory, you've joined us on stage. You're going to be the last speaker today, Mr. Gregory. So make sure that your question is a good one.
Okay, no pressure, I guess. Sorry if there's background noise. I'm a bit outside. But yeah, the French-German cooperation was mentioned a little briefly. Something that I don't see get commented on all that much is how the future of that collaboration is going to work when it seems as though the populations are going in very different directions politically. Right now, the second and third place candidates for the presidency, and I know we're far out, are both kind of like far right types, including one guy who announced yesterday and who literally said they will not replace us as part of his starter speech. And he's polling at 40% in a head-to-head against Macron. So this guy is more extreme than like Bjorn Höcke, even in Germany, who is seen as like the most extreme. And it just shows how like the electorate is very different from the German electorate on lots of questions. And with Annalena Baerbock as kind of like the foreign minister, who represents kind of things that like have pushed the French to these right-wing figures. I'm wondering if there's like any analysis in Germany of like these trends in France, if it's seen as less reliable, if it's kind of dismissed. I just haven't seen much coverage about how Germans are processing this or how the French, actually I see more about how the French are processing the kind of like greenward shift in Germany than I do the other way around.
I think after leaving Afghanistan, we discussed in Germany and also on the level of the NATO, which are the aims of the NATO in the future. Yeah, because the leaving of Afghanistan has been too short. In between, I think 3-4 months, and what happened in the airport of Kabul, it was a catastrophe. And so we discuss the next 12 months or the next 1-2 years, which are the aims of the Bundeswehr, of the German army, in between the NATO and in the actions in Africa, in Asia, or how you like it. And this will be a very, very interesting discussion, I think. I was astonished that the Bundeswehr, who gets much, much money every year, is not able to protect the airport of Kabul and to migrate. The people, the Afghan people, who are working for the Bundeswehr and for the development organizations, the German organizations, that they're not able to protect them and to transport them to Uzbekistan and then to Germany.
To the point I was making to Manville, that the German army doesn't have the technical wherewithal for any level of a complex mission outside of German borders, let alone defending against an aggressive army. And it's a deliberate policy. You know, the German army doesn't have the material or the logistics the way that the French and the British do, who are global players in a way that Germany just isn't.
I don't know if my question wasn't heard, but I don't think it was addressed. And maybe it's just too in the weeds about France for anyone on stage to really answer. But
I do think, Alex, it was actually a fair question. Very obviously, the drivers of the EU are France and Germany. Germany provides the money and the economic stability, and deliberately is always half a step emotionally behind France. France is the emotional leader of Europe. But German politics, domestic politics, isn't French politics. The two things are very, very different. Though you do have, and Tyrion and Udo can speak much better to this than me, you know, you do have a far-right fringe, which is popular in the eastern bit of Germany. But what they don't have are those kind of charismatic, kind of semi-intellectual figures like what you're getting in France, let alone, you know, the Front National, who are now, I know them now, rename themselves, who have been getting, 25, 30% of presidential votes for forever and a day. So,
yeah, and I think every time there's an election in many of these countries, the sort of pondering comes up, oh, what if the far right wins? I think when you're observing a country next door, if you're observing France or you're observing the Netherlands from Germany, it's you know, the media is going to make a big deal about it. But I think the general population is just going to wait and see. But this kind of worry mongering happens every election. So if it happens, then we'll have to deal with it. But I wouldn't say that the German population, the French population, are way far apart from one another on a lot of issues. Is there a certain percentage of the French population that's a little bit more Euroskeptical, a little bit more right leaning? Yes, but I think when you get down to two candidates in France, and it's really about EU yes or no, I think it's going to look a little bit different than right now. And 40% is not anywhere near where Brexit was.
And on that note, I'm going to say, folks, thank you for joining us, if you've been in the audience, for this edition of Mid-Atlantic, which has been the first time that we've ever dealt with a country in Europe in its entirety. So we looked at the German election, which was decided on the 26th of September. But it's only now, as we are at the start of December, that the coalition government has its agreement in place and will actually take office. So Tyrion Fischer, I would like to thank you for doing an excellent job explaining the machinations of German politics for us. Udo, thank you for joining us on stage. Kelly Saunders, as always, you're always welcome. Manville Smith, we thank you for your question. And thank you, Alex. You threw in a great question right at the end. If you're in the audience, please give everybody a follow. They're great people on this app, and we need to keep this app going. And the only way we're going to do that is by following people. And also in it, kind of getting into the meat of great discussions, but always being respectful to people, whether we actually agree with them or not. So give everybody a follow if you're in the audience. Also, hit the icon for Mid-Atlantic. Generally, I do these shows on either a Wednesday or a Thursday, generally in the middle of the week. We normally deal with US and UK politics. Every now and then, we'll throw in something different. Today was one of those days. So if you like to hear somebody talk passionately and insightfully about politics from around the world, come and join the Mid-Atlantic Club. Don't forget, there is a podcast. And if you're listening to the podcast, and I know that some 5,000 people religiously every week download the Mid-Atlantic podcast. If you're listening to the podcast and you'd like to be in effect here for one of the live recordings, quite simply download the Clubhouse app. You can do that by going into the Apple iTunes called for a second, or on the Google Play Store. Download the app, create a profile, then find Mid-Atlantic, and then you will be alerted whenever we go live with one of these shows, and you can be in the audience. You can ask a question. It's like a live podcast. Don't forget, folks, left of center politics is right thinking politics, but we don't demonize our right leaning brothers and sisters. We just try and win them over with the strength of our arguments. There you go. That's Mid-Atlantic. Again, Tyrion, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Royfield. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And
thank you very much.
Oh, they're very so polite. Manville, where was your thank you?
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Gregory, it's not obligatory to say thank you. I don't know why everyone's being so polite today, but it's something lovely to behold. I'm going to log off and say goodbye, everybody. Look after yourselves, but look after your loved ones even better. Take care. We'll see you all next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.